Question 1, 2, 3, testing.
This is Leon Gortler. I'm talking with Henry Taube on the way to Grand Central Station on March 19th, 1986. We'll try this and hope the batteries hold out. You already answered the question of why you left Cornell for Chicago. I guess it just wasn't stimulating enough.
I don't know whether... I don't know yet whether I would have continued that there if I had continued. I think my chances were perhaps good. But the fact was, I didn't enjoy the environment, and I really wanted out. I was attracted to these other places. I thought that life could easily be more fun. Oh, I should mention that Cornell also was run under the German system. I didn't spend much time on Cornell because, in fact, it was probably, if I choose any of the places, I've been the nadir of my career. And one of the things that I didn't like at all was that, in contrast to Berkeley, it was highly compartmentalized. There was an inorganic and analytic and an organic and a physical division. And mine, particularly the inorganic division, was run on a sort of rather strict authoritarian style.
I see.
And I didn't really get along with the man that ran it. This is not for publication. I simply did not respect him as a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not even respect him as a teacher. I didn't think he understood chemistry. He had a responsible position there.
It was, in fact, the physical chemist who had from Cornell, who had sort of built this minor empire. He was the fellow who, I think, started the Journal of Physical Chemistry. And,
He wasn't. He was emeritus by the time I got there.
Yeah.
And the name would come back. He was a colloid chemist.
Apparently.
You remember that? I think he was.
No.
It was called Physical and Colloid Chemistry.
I see.
I think.
Uh huh.
And the name might come to
And he had...
He died during the time I was there, but he was quite elderly.
Sort of always, kind of at loggerheads with the Berkeley School of Physical Chemistry.
Yes,
they really
yes.
saw things quite differently.
That's,
I think
that
he was more of a classicist.
I hadn't thought of him for many years, but the name of the bank. In fact, I know that I have a phonograph record in my collection that came out of his estate.
I see.
Because he got disposed of some of the things that they taught me from. So I do have this little bit of a connection with him. It's a shame I can't remember his name. But you remember.
Yes,
we're thinking about the same.
Yeah, I have a thesis on my desk.
I don't want to leave the impression that I was socially unhappy. I was not. I have dear friends there now. Lynn Horton and I, both Hortons, are very dear friends of mine, always will be. And Cy Bauer was among the few who would ask me a question about what I was doing. No, in fact, I would say that apart from my friend Rubin, whom I mentioned, that Cy Bauer was the only one who ever came up to me and said, "What are you doing today? What are you doing?"
And that was so different from what you'd had at Berkeley.
In a sense, it couldn't have been a greater contrast. I obviously believe that the Berkeley system, where it can be practiced, is better.
I was concerned you'll even see my doubts in the article about why Berkeley, where Lewis had, set the stage for the whole bonding theory and what have you, always was rather weak in organic chemistry. And some people say that Lewis hated organic chemists. The organic chemists on the staff were people who had invariably gotten degrees with him until Calvin arrived, and then in the 40s, 1940s, they hired some real organic chemists with the others. And I wonder if you had any feeling about that, or you were just a student.
Well, I think there was the feeling that he didn't really appreciate the synthetic organic chemist skill. And he really had the feeling that all chemistry was physical chemistry. Mm-hmm. And the synthetic organic chemist wouldn't appreciate thermodynamics, for example, in a way that he thought that every person who called himself a chemist should have. So he probably did have unreasonable mindsets. And nobody would ever accuse us of being entirely reasonable in every department. He was opinionated, and he was arrogant, too. Mm-hmm. Could do all. But he had respect for all of us.
When you went to Chicago, you joined the chemistry department, did you also have an appointment at the institutes?
No, I was one of the ones that was brought in solely for the department. And the having two classes of citizens caused a bit of a problem. And we were treated as second-class citizens. We were not members of the institute. I didn't really learn how badly until I was chosen by my colleagues to be the next chairman.
Okay, you followed Warren Johnson.
That's correct. And it was rather embarrassing for Warren. Warren was a friend and a good supporter, because before he sort of turned over the reins of office to me, he called me in and said, "Well, Henry, I'm in sort of an embarrassing position. As chairman, you're going to look at the books. You're going to see that your salary isn't commensurate with that of other people who are in the institute." But I adjusted it because, I know that it's difficult to keep things fair, and even an administrator does what he needs to keep the institution going.
Right.
And, of course, I got a big boost in salary when I became chairman. I thought that, on the whole, I was treated well enough. I never went in and asked for a raise.
Did the chairman of the chemistry department wheel and deal for the people in the institutes as well, or was that a totally separate unit?
No, I think actually, I don't really know how that, but I should remember how that was done, because I was chairman for a while. I think they had separate budgets, so in a sense, of course, he had no real responsibility, if that were true. I just don't remember. But I know that this point that I've raised helped me enormously as chairman, because he's an ordinary expression. I sort of had Warren by the short hair. And he was very generous during my term of chairmanship in providing support for the department. He was very good to us. He found money when I thought none existed.
He was dean for
He became dean, yes. I should have mentioned
that. Yeah. Right. No, I knew that, but I couldn't remember quite what dean he was.
The other thing to make a it was that I was really a very poor chairman, in the sense that I didn't understand budgets. I'd really had no administrative experience before, but at least the department didn't fall apart while I was chairman. And I think the credit for it surviving probably belongs to Warren, because I think in a real sense, he did part of my job for me.
I see. Of course, that has been a hard position to handle, because, Hutchins was gone already by the time he became chairman. Right? I think Kempton was probably president at that time.
Yeah.
There was a very long period from Stieglitz to Johnson where the department had no chairman at all. In Chicago.
Oh, and, was during the war years.
No. Oh. It was from approximately 1933 to 1945 or 46.
I didn't know that.
He absolutely refused to appoint a chairman from within the department, and there was an enormous search, and I found in the archives lists of people who were considered for the position, a number of Europeans.
So Hutchins didn't trust his own faculty.
I think it may have been that he didn't care for Karas at all. I mean, Karas was a logical choice. Yeah. Schlesinger essentially ran the department during that whole period. There was essentially a troika running the department for a number of years of Karas, Harkins, and Schlesinger. And Schlesinger was essentially the chairman of the committee, so he ran the department, but he never had the... the way Grant Urey tells it, that Hutchins absolutely refused to appoint Schlesinger chairman, too. I can't remember quite what it was that he had against him, but I think...
When I was first interviewed at Chicago, Schlesinger was acting in place of a chairman.
That's right. So there was no chairman. Johnson had not been appointed yet.
Correct. And by the time I got there, Johnson was chairman.
Okay.
And in the interim between being invited and being appointed, I actually got a raise in salary. Because Schlesinger, I think, tended to follow Stieglitz's tradition of saving the administration money,
right,
which was brought up. I mean, nothing against them.
Mm-hmm.
He believed that, well, we shouldn't be spent with it, and they could buy me at that. And I was happy to come up. I was so pleased to learn and surprised that I learned it was Bill Libby who had a look at the books. And I guess Libby probably compared mine with Clyde, Hutchison, and some others, and decided that they weren't paying me enough. But I have no bitterness to Chicago about salary questions at all. During my entire time there, even though I've mentioned it, that wasn't one of the things I worried about.
Oh, okay. What were the conditions like in Chicago when you got there in terms of facilities and laboratories?
Well, my requirements at the beginning were very modest. I had done experiments often falling rates by simple titration.
Mm-hmm.
Spectrophotometers were not yet universally available. I did acquire a Beckman spectrophotometer rather soon after arriving there, and I don't remember whether... I probably got that through the ONR, because my first research support came from them. And that was during the good old days when they came to the universities and they asked people to please accept some support. I mean, we'd like to support some of your research.
I see.
And then a little bit later, the AEC came into the picture, and I was given a mass spectrometer by them. And in that respect, I have, again, no complaints whatever. My needs continued to be modest. In fact, I had a very difficult time adjusting to the new ways, because I thought we were begging for support.
Yeah.
And I wondered about other people who should have been supported who weren't getting support. It took me a while to get used to the new ways. And the mass spectrometer stood me in very good stead, because it allowed us to do a number of stable isotope tracer and isotope fractionation experiments.
Was this one that Urey had built, or was this
it was a commercial instrument.
Uh-huh.
And it was very good. I think that its precision was about only three times worse than the refined machine that Urey's group put together, which I understand gave accuracy at the level of electronics of those days. They had really taken everything out of it. You just couldn't do anything better with the electronics. But Urey had a magnificent mass spectrometer. He needed very precise isotopes. one part in 10 to the 4th for 018 at natural level, something to put you back. And I think our mass spectrum would be with quite a bit short of that. We're certainly useful for isotopic tracing work. And what's very useful for the first measurement of the number of water molecules that are bound by a cation in the aqueous solution.
How in the world did you do that by mass spectrometry?
Well, I had, in the course of giving my course, I had deduced that water molecules would stick to chromium ion, that they would exchange slowly, and of all of the ones that were sort of accessible, I chose that as the one most likely to yield an interesting result. You know, now people ask, why was that a significant experiment? Well, many may not appreciate is that in those days, many physical chemists thought that all reactions of inorganic ions were using the term instantaneous in freshman books. You know, they would be very, very rapid. And when John Hunt, who undertook to do the measurements, started to work with me, we didn't have a mass spectrometer. And the idea was that you would take a solution containing hexoxychromic ion, dissolved in ordinary water, and then you would spike it with a given amount of water enriched in OAT. And you'd of course get instantaneous dilution of the OAT isotope by the free water. But you wouldn't get dilution by the water that's bound to the chromium. If no water were held back by the chromium, you'd get a certain value. The O18 the ratio of the 18 to O16 would be a certain value.
Right.
If on the other hand the chromium held back six waters,
yes,
the isotopic enrichment would remain higher.
Right.
And by looking at that difference, you could then determine the
very clever experiment.
And it was an important experiment, and I've heard physical chemists of my age acknowledge that, publicly saying that they were astonished that an inorganic alkaline would be so slow to undergo substitution. And of course, the study of hydration of ions continues to this day. We did some of the very easy ones, and people are doing important hard ones now. Now that, what is that? I see.
Let me stop for just a minute. See, I hope the batteries hold out. These were. Who were the people you interacted with most at Chicago? Say something about the people on the staff there.
I think with Frank Westheimer, that's very easy. Because each of us understood what the other was trying to do, and it was different enough so that, you know, it had sort of a fresh flavor.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you look at Frank's early review article on the chemistry of chromium 6, oxidation of chromium 6, you'll note that he acknowledges me in the appropriate section. And I participated in all those discussions. I learned an awful lot from them. And I learned especially to appreciate Frank's precision of thinking. Certainly didn't allow any sloppiness in his thinking. It turns out that Libby and I had known each other since Berkeley days. In fact, my first wife and his then wife, Laura Lee, were very good friends. And I knew the family. And it was always easy in Bill Libby's presence Billy B was interested in electron transfer reactions, that he all of a sudden understood the subject. There's nothing more to say about it. But I know that Bill also respected the work that I was doing. And he was a stimulating colleague. He'd ask you challenging questions. But he'd do it in such a manner that you knew he wasn't trying to put you down. He wanted to get a discussion going. And in fact, he did make an important basic contribution to the field of what's called, electron transfer reactions in chemistry. Because he was really the person who publicized the relevance of quantum restriction to the thermal electron transfer process. Now, Franck himself appreciated the relevance of the restriction, as did Katzmann, who was, a student of Franck. But Franck never pushed the idea, whereas Libby got up publicly and talked about it. And then he made another very important contribution. I think he was instrumental for organizing a symposium. It was held, I think, in 1952 at the Roman Catholic School in Indiana?
Notre Dame.
On electron transfer processes. And it had to be somebody with Libby's sort of broad view of things, because it dealt with electron transfer in the gas phase, theoretical and experimental, and then dealt also with sort of theoretical papers to the extent that one could theorize for the processes in condensed phase. He himself gave a paper, and down to rather detailed reports on what they call self-exchange processes now, and on some relatively simple oxidation-reduction reactions. Now, I didn't attend that symposium, but it had an enormous impact on the field, not so much, I'd say, for the papers themselves as for the discussion that ensued. And it's rather interesting that the idea, which, we all discussed among ourselves, that inorganic reactions might proceed like organic ones, that the thing that we call electron transfer might really involve atom transfer. That actually is documented, I think, for the first time in the literature in some comments that H.C. Brown made following a paper on the self-exchange rate between iron 2 and iron 3. Dodson and Silverman had measured the iron 2, iron 3 self-exchange for two of the halides and found that the reaction is more efficient when chloride mediates the reaction than when bromide. And one interpretation would be that these are bridging ions.
Yes.
And Brown even suggests that this is almost an expected organ.
Uh-huh.
But at that time, there was no experimental proof of the validity of that this mechanism really obtained. And then a third mechanism, which belongs, obviously must be a controlling factor, so-called hydrogen atom transfer. I think nowadays we say electron motion plus the proton motion, because you have to move charge in solution. And that also, for the first time, I think, was enunciated as a theory. It was a very important meeting. I wasn't there, but still it was important for my own work at home.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of new people who came into the department at that time.
Tremendous influx. You have to count the people in the institute when I say that.
Right.
That came into the department proper. Perhaps I was the only one at that time.
Uh-huh.
But there were about five or six people of my age. Let's see if I can remember them. Norman Nocturne, Fred Hutchison, Tony Kirkovich, Nate Sugarman, Elliot, who then went to Brookhaven, Jake Beagle-Eisen. Well, I think there were two categories. There was a category of maybe instructor, assistant professor, and then there was a category of sort of a high-level postdoctoral fellow.
Uh-huh.
And I think Jake Beagle-Eisen was in that category, and Harold Dodgen and a few others. And these were all very, very good people.
Yeah, that's quite a cast.
Yeah. And I didn't get very far on people who showed special interest. But then we
go
to it, and it turned out that Karosh and I had a lot of interest in common, because during my years at Cornell, I really worked on inorganic free radical reactions. So I knew quite a bit about Karosh's work.
Uh-huh.
And Karosh and Bill Urey and I, never together, but separately, had many interesting discussions on problems in chemistry. And I think Boris, occasionally came to see me. I often came to see him. Schlesinger never, I think, had any feeling for my work. He was deeply involved in boron chemistry, but I know that Schlesinger was a very strong supporter of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I would guess that Frank Westheimer would have influenced him, and maybe Bill Libby. I know that Frank thought very well of my review paper in which I correlated rates of substitution with electronic structure. He never said anything to me directly, but somebody passed on a remark to Frank.
Well, that's true, and you passed a harsh judge. He really is a very quality-conscious person.
Yeah. But it's a paper that I continue to be proud of. It has to be read in the context of its time. When I was asked to give a paper at the Pauling birthday celebration, I thought that I might talk about Pauling and his contributions to inorganic chemistry, but I decided it would be difficult for me to do, because the success that I had in that paper depended on putting aside some implications of Pauling's view. I mean, I realized that the description of inorganic complexes as ionic and covalent didn't really go beyond the magnetic criterion that soon became apparent to me, that the ionic complexes could actually be easily more covalent than the ones he called covalent. That he was really talking about low spin complexes on the one hand, where all of the non-bonding orbitals were occupied. This is the modern language. And then complexes on the other, where some of the non-bonding orbitals were empty, or you had antibonding electrons. And I saw that he was confusing covalency with rate of substitution, in effect.
I see.
So chromic ion is slow, and the correlation I introduced was done without understanding Ligand field theory, and I did it actually in the language of the bond theory. I simply pointed out that what we're talking about is rates, not equilibrium properties. And the correlation survived the change from valence bond theory to, let's say, Ligand field theory, because it was a valid experimental basis. I think that those are the main people that I had anything to do with. But the fact is that simply as a member of a department, I was invited to give seminars in front of my colleagues. And I think that's the point that somebody, that's the thing that may not have been mentioned to you. it was a very important function in the early history of the chemistry department. I mean, this includes the chemists from the institute. And Joe Mayer had the idea of bringing all the chemists together on a Wednesday afternoon when coffee and cookies or donuts would be furnished. And then after people had had a chance to chat with each other, what they would do, Joe would look around the room and he'd pick out one of his colleagues and say, well, Mikey Henry, we haven't heard from you before. Would you get up and tell us what you're doing in research? And it was wonderful. It was informal, and all of us, of course, were deeply immersed in research. And I remember starting to talk, and time went on, and I was asked to continue the next time, and I really felt very flattered. I mean, this is a tremendous contrast to Cornell, where I was never invited during my entire time to give a seminar to my colleagues.
Because you were there, you were...
I was an inorganic chemist.
Were probably, you know, if they were really Germanic, you were sort of fairly down to the table.
I was way down, because I had very little contact with Dubai. Dubai would get in touch with Elton here about being able to tell him what to do or think.
I see. Oh, my.
I did not admire Dubai as chairman. And it was impossible to, because he did not fit my idea of the chairman of a department like the Department of Berkeley. But I guess for Cornell organizing, he was comfortable. Mm-hmm. He did not, I have to say, take much interest in the younger colleagues, unless, of course, they were working close to his own interests. Mm-hmm. He felt no responsibility for that. And I think that when he was named, they pretty well understood what they would be getting, and I think it worked out well for him, because he was a highly respected scientist, an extremely good scientist,
right.
And he could give them a lot of good.
Did you get the impression in Chicago that there was sort of a philosophy that the organic chemists followed? That is, it was the one department that I've come across where there were no classical organic chemists in the sense that we think of classical organic chemists, you know.
It might have been the Stieglitz influence, I suppose.
Yes, and before him, but
yes,
we
would call physical organic chemists now, wouldn't we?
42nd Street exit closed.
That's
oh, how ridiculous. Oh, my. All right. You're going to get a bigger ride.
I'm sure. How far do you have to go now?
Well, I'll go to 61st Street and then come back. And,
well, I guess... organic chemistry was pretty well full up when I was there, because the institutes, as far as I can remember, saw no need to appoint any organic chemists. So the organic chemists...
Right.
just mentioned that Frank was really a cement in the department. He interacted with people, whether they're physical chemists, inorganic chemists, or whatever, analytical chemists. And
it started very early on. I mean, one of his early important papers was that work with, I guess he did some work with Joe Mayer, and he did work with Kirkwood, who was there for only a short period.
Yeah, the work with Kirkwood was a very important paper. He did one on hindered rotation in diphenyl.
That's right.
I think that was with physical chemists, wasn't it?
Yes.
I didn't know about that he had a paper with Mayer.
I think on a very similar kind of program. They were very close to the Mayers, I guess.
Yes, yes they were. I suppose if Frank had stayed at Chicago, I'd still be there.
Oh.
Because when he left, it made a big difference to me because... I guess my social relationships with my colleagues remain warm and cordial, but in terms of our work, we began to take each other for granted, sort of. The cross-fertilization of ideas was not so noticeable toward the end of my stay there as it was early. This wonderful seminar that I talked about, I think, lasted only about 2 years.
Yes.
And I still don't remember why it was given up. So it may be that...
It sounds very familiar, having been in other departments where you have things like even our own department, where every so often somebody will get the idea of having a close a seminar among colleagues. Our newest faculty member, Leslie Davenport, has started a literature seminar each week.
Yeah.
That's what young people do, and then after a while you get off on your own thing.
It's strange that I don't remember how or when that seminar was discontinued. I guess it died with a whimper. Not with a bang.
Do you have any particular philosophy when you were chairman?
No, I didn't. I was really not ready for the chairmanship, I have to say. And still puzzled as to why my colleagues selected me. I think that I was the least objectionable of a number of alternatives. And they felt I'd cause less trouble than anyone else. There was I got involved in a way that was very unpleasant for me early. That's not quite the word, I don't know. But I'll tell you the story because it spoiled my life as chairman for at least a year and a half. I had not gotten the chairman's seat won when Morris Karrasch came in and said, that I am proposing Walter Nudenberg for a tenured position in the department. But there was a preamble. He said, my group is getting to be very big and I can't run it alone, and I have Walter running it all this time. Now Walter has had an attractive offer from industry, and I'm going to lose Walter unless the department gives him position as a tenured professor. And I pointed out to Morris I thought there would be difficulty with that in the department because I felt that my colleagues had the view that every faculty member would be independent in research. And Carr said, yes, I understand the feeling on this in the department, but, you know, I think I'd like to argue the case, and would you, as chairman, introduce it for discussion? I said, of course, Morris, I will. And he said, would you, as chairman, support it? And, you know, I was a tactful young man. I could have avoided the issue, but never my way. I said, no, Morris, I can't. I wouldn't support it. And he didn't expect that from me, because he probably felt that I was a bit pliable or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned white in his face. He walked up and down in my office and said, well, in that case, I have no alternative but to resign. And I didn't really know how to handle it. I didn't really handle it. I did, I think, what was the right thing. I didn't do anything.
That's right. You know, I would feel much the same way. What can you do in a situation like
and
that?
And eventually a letter came from him, a formal letter of resignation. And I think I responded to that in some way. And then events began to take place. Morris published the news that he was leaving the University of Chicago and was looking for a place that he could be more comfortable in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that he got any offers, but there were a couple of phone calls to me, and people inquired into the circumstances. I didn't badmouth Morris anyway, because I have both a respect and a love him as a person.
Mm-hmm.
But he could be difficult.
The impression I get from talking to other people.
Yeah, he could be difficult. He'd get stubborn. You know, he made a mistake in resigning in my presence like that. And an older man, if I had been more his age, I could have gone in and patted him on the shoulder. Come on, Morris, you don't really mean that.
Right.
What can we do to keep you here? But we weren't on that basis, and I don't think I could have done that.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did then, though, was to persuade the administration, let's make an arrangement for Morris so that he can stay here and is comfortable with his resignation of the department. And we talked the administration into creating an institute.
Oh, that's when the institute
that's
was
correct.
Formed.
Yeah.
Aha.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the question of his relations to the park department were never defined. I think it was better not to go into any details. I don't think any articles of agreement were drawn up. It essentially meant that Morris operated as he did before, which was sort of independent of the rest of the department.
Which didn't really change a hell of a lot,
it
right?
It changed a hell of a lot.
Right.
Well, but in the course of this very bad blood, very bad feelings between Mrs. Karlosh and me, other members of the Karlosh family and me, and also former students of Morris Karlosh, who didn't know what went on. And Mary, in fact, invented a new verb. It's not a verb, it's a participle, Karlosh. I was Karlosh for about almost 2 years. Well, the reason that it's tragic is that Morris died shortly after he had his institute, and I can't help but feel that the tension, it was not an easy time for him, that he went through had its effect. I remember sitting behind Morris looking at, when he was older than I, looking at the back of his head.
Newton
God, what a shame.
Before the formation of the Institute, then. I guess he took that attractive offer.
Yeah. Well, I talked to Walter, and I explained the department's position, and, you know, Walter and I were friends, personal friends. Walter was very helpful to me sometimes when I needed a piece of apparatus or needed access to a vac line. Always cooperative, always fun to talk to, but it really was a principle in the department, and one that we wouldn't have violated for anyone. And I think by then, Walter was so sick of the whole situation that he wouldn't have stayed on it. And he's a very nice, I don't know whether you know him or met him. He went into industry.
Yes.
I think he did extremely well. To this day, I don't know whether he was.
Rush had the habit of using people, though, in much that way.
Yeah.
Frank Mayo left as a result of that.
Right,
I guess H.C. Brown wasn't really used.
It would be hard to use.
Yes,
it.
Right.
It's tougher than most.
There's a letter which I was almost, it was in the archive, which I was almost embarrassed to read. It was a letter, I think, concerning Bill Urey. I can't remember who wrote the letter. It was the administration suggesting that Bill Urey might leave the university because they were afraid that he was just too linked to Karash, and it would be far better for him and his career if he went elsewhere and would be sort of separated from
Karash. Well, he cut himself off from Karash, but that was not without some difficulty and anguish. I'm not sure they remained good friends after that.
I see.
Yes, it's quite true. You see, Morris had this way of dealing with people.
Well,
there's another.
And even, I think, Clyde Dillard told me that you should talk to Gutenberg one day because he felt very used by,
in retrospect. He never said that to me because he had this tremendous respect for Morris.
Yeah.
But we thought that he was being used. Yes, we did.
Maybe.
Because he never published an independent paper, I think it always had Morris's name on it.
Yeah.
And yet there was absolutely nothing wrong with Walter's brains. No. See, but for that a stipulation that Walter would continue to work with him, Walter would have been a serious contender for a position if it had existed. There was another point we'd have to show that we needed a position.
Well, it's interesting because then N.C. Yang was there and eventually did kind of end up in that position, I guess.
I guess. I didn't really follow the... Yeah, I think he did in a way, yeah.
Because he came in with a fellow by the name of Rudy to take over Nudenberg's position.
That's correct.
And then shortly thereafter, Karash died.
Yeah, Tom Rudy went to Shell Development.
That's right. He went back into industry.
And I heard from Tom about a couple of years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I've seen him since.
Uh-huh.
He's not, well, Shell Development closed, I think, that when they moved to Houston, Tom left, stayed in the area, and he has a different job now. Well, I know that Tom never had any bad feelings toward me on account of my dealings with Morris.
Now, how you remain chairman until?
I think the term of office was 3 years.
I see. So you didn't stay chairman until you left the...
No. I had a fill of it, and I was simply no good at it. I couldn't keep books. I really took advantage of
Jimmy Parsons
Warren
Johnson.
Yeah.
I see.
And you can't run a department in the red every year.
No.
Well, the department was treated very poorly, though it was true by the administration, because it was traditional. It came from Stieglitz, and we'd never been able to break that tradition, in contrast to the way the institute.
I wanted to ask you about your own philosophy of handling, the high pressures of working at a major university. That is, you mentioned today that you worked so hard at Cornell, it disrupted your family life. How do you think that affected you?
I didn't think of it in those terms. I mean, I wanted to do what I was doing, and I don't think I could have done anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And it was only a factor in the breakup of the marriage. But I didn't spend enough time with my family. I didn't have enough time for them. I didn't really get to know my wife. It's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
The person was really so rapid.
How did your wife after that handle that?
You see, by then circumstances had changed. Because, the trouble was that at Cornell, all the research I did was with my own hands.
Right.
You see.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got graduate students, the relationship changed. I still worked in the laboratory, sometimes in the evening, but I didn't have that for example, I wouldn't work all night anymore, as I did at Cornell very often. So it was a much more normal married life. I've learned something in the interim. I was actually too green to get. I was too green for a lot of things that happened. But, grow up.
Yes. Survive. Yeah. Fortunate that we do learn. I guess man is such an animal.
Well, this is going.
The previous day, I had asked Henry Tabby about George Whalen. I told him that Frank Westheimer had said that George Whalen was one of the brightest people he had ever met, but that for some reason he didn't have the energy to produce the products that his mind might have been capable of producing. Henry indicated that he disagreed with that analysis. He thought that Whalen had a very narrow view of chemical problems, that his answer to most problems was resonance, and that he couldn't see the other effects that might be important in the explanation of certain observations. During Dr. Tabby's talk today, he spoke of a memoir for G.N. Lewis that had been written by Joel Hildebrand. I assume that was a memoir from the National Academy of Sciences. In that memoir, Hildebrand indicated that during the Lewis years at Berkeley, the department was never divided up into sub-disciplines, that everyone essentially practiced chemistry, and that everyone worked on all kinds of problems. Last two comments were a postscript added on the evening of March 19th after I dropped Henry Tabby off at Grand Central Station.